Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Drunk Driver Blood Tests and the Fourth Amendment Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 9, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Missouri v. McNeely. The question in this case is whether the Fourth Amendment's exigent circumstances doctrine permits a law enforcement officer to take a warrantless, non-consensual blood sample from a drunk driver because of the natural dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream over time. To discuss the case, we have Eric Jaffe, a Washington, D.C. attorney who specializes in appellate litigation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Jaffe.
My name is Eric Jaffe. I am the head of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group of the Federalist Society. But today I will, in fact, be talking about the Fourth Amendment, and particularly the case of Missouri versus McNeely, which was argued on January 9th, 2013. I'd like to thank the Federal Society for inviting me to discuss this case. Missouri versus McNeely, the issue before the court was whether a police officer needed to obtain a warrant in order to draw blood from a suspect arrested for drunk driving. The suspect had been pulled over for erratic driving, had failed the field sobriety test, had refused a breathalyzer, and was being taken to the hospital, and the officer involved, believing that he did not need a warrant, instructed the hospital to take a blood sample in order to test blood alcohol level. This was challenged, and eventually the defense won and got the evidence excluded. And as it comes up to the Supreme Court, really the two sides took two fairly disparate positions on whether or not a warrant was required in the situation where you have a suspect who is believed to be drunk at the time, but given that the body metabolizes alcohol, the evidence of that drunkenness was presumably disappearing more slowly or more quickly with every minute that passed, and so the state has a desire to preserve the evidence. And the state's position was that there should be a per se rule that for drunk driving arrests, there is no warrant requirement because of the exigent need to preserve the evidence of drunkenness, which is dissipating at a relatively constant rate as time passes. And their view is this is just like any other destruction of evidence case where the suspect is flushing the drugs down the toilet or hiding the gun or throwing it in the river, and you need to preserve the evidence, which will be lost if you don't act expeditiously. The defense's view was that no, you need a warrant unless there are special extrinsic circumstances that make getting a warrant impractical, and that while getting a warrant may introduce some degree of delay, it's not so extreme as to justify excusing the warrant requirement, and that the evidence of drunkenness, while perhaps dissipating a little bit, is not going to disappear entirely, and that at least in situations where there's nothing hindering your ability, no external circumstances hindering your ability to get a warrant, you should be required to get the warrant, even if it means you don't get as good evidence as you might otherwise get. And the respondent, the defense, in its favor, has an earlier decision by the Supreme Court in a case called Schmerber, in which the court discussed the situation of a warrantless blood draw for an accident that was suspected to involve drunkenness. And the court had some extended discussion about why the special circumstances in that case excused the warrant requirement, because the police officer had to secure the scene, had to investigate the scene, had to get the victims to the hospital. There were all kinds of things relating to the accident that made it impractical to pause to go get a warrant. The trouble the state has in this case is that those kinds of extrinsic circumstances aren't available. The state is simply arguing that any delay, no matter what the cause, even if the cause is that you don't happen to have a magistrate on duty or the cause is that it takes 10 minutes for the judge to think about it, is too much and creates an exigent circumstance. During oral argument, neither view, either of the state or of the defendant, really was getting much takers. There was absolutely no interest at all in a per se no warrant requirement. I don't think any member of the court believed that that was the right answer, that under every circumstance, no matter how quickly you could get a warrant, that the marginal diminution in blood alcohol content because of just basic metabolism was a sufficient exigent circumstance to justify excusing the warrant requirements. By the same token, there were, I thought, almost no takers for the notion that you can only look at extrinsic circumstances that might cause the delay, but that you cannot look at what are described as intrinsic circumstances, just the intrinsic or inherent delay in fetching a prosecutor, fetching a judge, filling out the forms, and getting somebody to respond to you, no matter what time of day or night you're asking for this. I think everyone had at least some sympathy for the notion that the world is not perfectly efficient and that warrants don't just pop up magically moments after you ask for them, and that sometimes the prosecutor is not available, sometimes the judge is not available, sometimes it takes a little while to fill out the form if you're not in a highly computerized or telephonic warrant jurisdiction. And so there was some sympathy for that as well. So neither the defendant's extreme position nor the state's extreme position was likely to have many takers. The two middle positions that seemed to be getting the most support on the court were, first, that you basically stick with the sort of totality of the circumstances analysis in Schmerber, but not limit those circumstances to only extrinsic circumstances, but include both extrinsic and intrinsic circumstances. So extrinsic circumstances being there's an accident, there's a storm, there's an outage, the judge is sick, whatever it is, those kinds of things external to the process. And intrinsic circumstances simply being the delay. It's 3 a.m. and it takes a while to rouse the judge. You need to go through a prosecutor and then through the judge. You need to fill out a form and fax it, whatever those intrinsic aspects of the warrant process itself are. And I think almost all the justices agreed that you would take into account both types of circumstances in assessing whether there was a truly exigent situation. So that was the one scenario which sort of stuck with the Schmerber rule, stuck with a case-by-case analysis of the circumstances there, and to a greater or lesser degree discussed whether or not any given set of circumstances would be sufficiently exigent to excuse the warrant requirement. So on that kind of a position, I think you had Justice Kennedy exhibiting some interest. You had Justice Alito exhibiting interest, though perhaps in a more lenient fashion that would cut the jurisdictions a little more slack, recognizing the difficulty of getting a warrant, particularly in places like rural jurisdictions where it might be hard to get a hold of a judge at 2 a.m. Justice Breyer, who might be a little stricter, who sort of had the view that it's not that difficult to get a warrant. Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, who likewise would be a little bit stricter in thinking that you should try to get the warrant and that if you lose a little evidence, that's okay. Justice Scalia, all 6 of those affirmatively expressing some support for this totality of the circumstances version that would also take into account the intrinsic delay in the process. The Chief and Justice Ginsburg didn't expressly sort of comment on the Schmerber totality situation, but their other comments, which we'll get to in a minute, sort of suggested that they would certainly be open to that kind of situation as well. The second approach that was sort of mentioned, which I think in some ways is stricter and in some ways is less strict than the totality situation, was that you have to at least try. That in all situations, you have to at least try to get a warrant. So once you've arrested a person suspected of drunk driving and you're taking them to the hospital anyway or you're taking them into the jail, there is some inherent delay before you could ever do the blood draw anyway in a hospital situation, so that you should try to get a warrant while you're en route or during the time of that inherent delay in transport. Justice Ginsburg specifically suggested, you know, why not try, and if you can't get one after 30 minutes, then you can go ahead, but that you're at least obligated to give it a shot. So Justice Ginsburg was the one who expressly raised this possibility. Justice Kennedy seemed to ask questions that looked favorably on that possibility. Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan also seemed to have some sympathy with this approach. Now, obviously, in some ways, it's stricter in that you have to try in every situation, no matter what, and that would be some of the circumstances that you would factor in, is did you try? And in some ways, it's less strict in that once 30 minutes is up, you get to take the blood, even if the totality of the circumstances might not otherwise support that. So it's unclear whether this is truly a separate factor or whether the 30 minutes and then go is perhaps just one of the circumstances. But those are the two middle positions that got the most favor, with the sort of Schmerber totality version getting the most favorable reading. In terms of where the justices stood, in terms of the spectrum of who was for and who was against the warrant requirement, I think it's fair to say that Justice Sotomayor was most strongly in favor of requiring warrants in more circumstances and had the least sympathy for the prospect of loss of evidence through bodily metabolism, noting that's always the trade-off in Fourth Amendment cases, is that you apply the Fourth Amendment and you get somewhat less good evidence than if you just ignored the Fourth Amendment but that's not an excuse to ignore the Fourth Amendment. So Justice Sotomayor was probably the strongest in favor of a more strict warrant requirement, followed by Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, and Breyer, no surprise on those, I imagine. Justice Kennedy being sort of fairly solidly in the middle, but both Kennedy and Scalia, I thought, were reasonably solidly in the middle, though both of them exhibited some sympathy to the problems of delay and the problem of dissipation of evidence. They weren't that sympathetic. They mentioned it a couple times. They understood it. But at the end of the day, I think they both thought that you at least need to make some effort. And then at the bottom was Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, both of whom showed the most sympathy to the damage that could happen from delay and loss of evidence. And of course, Justice Thomas, in usual fashion, didn't ask questions, so it's hard to peg where he might be. But one can imagine that he is somewhere in a similar scenario between, you know, Scalia, Roberts, and Alito in terms of having some sympathy for the delay and the loss of evidence, but not a ton of it. In fact, if anything, he might be a little closer to Kennedy on these things, if I had to guess. So that's sort of where everyone broke down. I think it's fair to say that there's no chance that the state is going to win this case, that the state is going to win the notion that it was okay to not have a warrant as a per se rule. And given the facts of the case where the officer didn't believe he needed a warrant and so made no effort to evaluate the circumstances, made no effort to try to get a warrant, it's hard to imagine that there's any chance of the decision, the outcome below, being reversed. And the reasoning as to why the outcome below is upheld will fall somewhere between a multi-factor Schmerber totality test and perhaps a slightly bright line which says you have to at least try. That as part of the circumstances, one of the things we will always take into account is whether you even tried. And if you didn't try, then presumably we're going to be pretty skeptical. A few other themes in the course of the argument I thought worth noting, themes both favoring warrants and favoring warrantless searches, themes that were in favor of a stricter warrant requirement. First, there was some discussion of a sort of a slippery slope possibility. Well, if we don't require warrants for these kinds of blood draws, you know, hospital blood draws following an arrest for drunk driving, well, what about roadside blood tests? Because obviously there's a delay in getting from the point of arrest to the hospital, and you're losing evidence during that point. Can a state then turn around and say, well, since delay justifies no warrant, let's just do the blood draw at the side of the road? And this kind of concern was expressed by Justices Kagan and a little bit by Justice Sotomayor. There was also concern that, well, can you go ahead and do a blood test even if they do consent to a breathalyzer test, where so you have the breath test, you have some pretty good evidence, but do you get to do an involuntary warrantless blood draw anyway because it's better evidence, because sometimes the breathalyzer is not perfect, because it might show other things like the presence of drugs, not merely alcohol? I took the questioning on those issues to be some evidence of concern that we'd just be opening up the floodgates if we adopted a per se rule of no warrants because you might lose evidence. And I think those concerns are probably right. A second theme sort of favoring maintaining a warrant requirement and perhaps even doing a case-by-case analysis was that there was some concern that if you say that you don't need a warrant because it takes too long, that's just a huge incentive to be inefficient. Right now, everyone sort of agreed that there are some situations where you can very quickly get a warrant, certainly some jurisdictions where it's all routinized. You can do it by phone, you can do it by electronic device, and that it really doesn't take very long. But other jurisdictions where it does take longer, and there was some concern that if you said you didn't need a warrant because in some places they can't do it that fast, you would discourage them from improving their efficiency, that you would be basing a national standard on the least efficient jurisdictions, and that these concerns meant that you shouldn't just simply dispose of the warrant requirement. And I think those kinds of concerns were sort of conveyed by questions from Justice Scalia, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Breyer. Justice Alito, by contrast, sort of questioned whether or not you'd really create those kinds of incentives, thinking that police had an incentive to get the warrant anyway, even if it was less efficient. But once again, I think that the incentives to be inefficient is a valid concern, that if you tell them if it takes a really long time, you don't need a warrant, well, then what's the incentive to have it take a shorter time? I would assign only one magistrate, make sure he wasn't available, things like that, and then you won't need a warrant. The third concern or third theme that would sort of favor warrants was the theme raised by Justice Sotomayor, which was that, you know, the state doesn't have a right to the best evidence to support its prosecution. That there's always a trade-off in the Fourth Amendment context. Whenever you apply the Fourth Amendment, you diminish and sometimes interfere with the state's ability to gather the best evidence of a crime. So you could have a warrantless search without reasonable suspicion to find a gun or find drugs, and that's the best evidence, but you kick it out anyway because you didn't get the warrant or you didn't have reasonable suspicion. And we accept the cost of degrading the state's evidence in certain cases in order to stop the state from abusing its authority in other cases. And this is a very common trade-off in the Fourth Amendment context. I thought Justice Sotomayor was right that this argument that we need the very best evidence we can get in every single case is an excuse that would work under any Fourth Amendment argument and therefore is not an excuse that really carries a lot of weight. Themes that sort of cut against the warrant requirement, the first big theme that kept cropping up and I think will carry some weight in the ultimate decision, is that there was a concern with sort of the intrinsic delay in the process of getting a warrant, particularly in small or rural jurisdictions. This was a theme Justice Alito came back to quite often, but that was echoed a bit by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia, that while it's well and good to say that in a large or modern jurisdiction, in a big city, New York or someplace like that, sure, there's always someone on call, there's always a prosecutor available, you have electronic means of submitting your warrant request, and so it can all happen very efficiently. But if you're out in the middle of the sticks and the closest judge is, you know, 150 miles away and he's asleep and there's only two of them and the other one's on vacation, not every place is as modernized and efficient as New York City might be. And I thought that was likewise a valid concern that while you don't want to give incentives to be inefficient, you can't hold everyone to the standard of a highly funded, highly staffed urban jurisdiction, that not every place has to spend that kind of money on their law enforcement resources. A second theme that cut against warrants, which I thought might have been somewhat just asked in a devil's advocate mode, was sort of there was some question as to the value of warrants in a routine DUI case. So both Justice Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts sort of wondered what value the warrant takes. The police calls up and said the guy was swerving. He failed the field sobriety test. Can I have a warrant? And the answer is always yes. There's almost no scenario where the answer is no. There's very little judgment involved. There's a couple of basic facts that are involved when you pull someone over for DUI. On the other hand, obviously the answer back is, well, if you didn't give a field sobriety test, if the only evidence you had for the warrant was, I think he's drunk, he crossed the white line once, well, maybe the warrant wouldn't issue. But anyway, there was at least some probing as to what value warrants really had in this case, and so what's the big deal of getting rid of a warrant requirement in routine DUI cases? Didn't seem like that was really going to go anywhere, but it was just an interesting theme, probably more to pressure the other side a little bit and see what they said. Finally, there were some mixed themes that had sort of mixed relevance, both for and against warrants, but that were likewise themselves sort of interesting as harbingers of stuff in the future, perhaps. One theme was the availability of less intrusive tests. For example, breathalyzer tests, urinalysis, or possibly in the future, sort of much less intrusive needle sticks comparable to sort of diabetes tests where you're not drawing blood from a vein, but you're just doing a quick needle stick, and perhaps that's less intrusive than the usual blood draw. And different justices questioned whether the availability of such tests, either now or in the future, would be relevant, and whether or not you'd need a warrant for them in the future if it was less intrusive. So it cut both ways in that if they are indeed available, maybe it diminishes the need to do a full-blown blood draw. But likewise, there was some suggestion that if given that they're less intrusive, maybe the reasonableness of a warrantless test that's less intrusive was more reasonable, and hence the need for a warrant in those circumstances would diminish. And I thought that was an interesting theme. There was some significant signal that if a state said, look, based on all the same concerns in this case, we're going to say that you don't need a warrant to do a breathalyzer test, and you can force folks who fail a field sobriety test to then take a breathalyzer, whether they consent or not, even without a warrant. It sounded to me like there was at least some reasonable support for that, given the far less intrusive nature of breathalyzer tests. So those themes, you had Justice Scalia commenting, you had Chief Justice Roberts, you even had Justice Sotomayor asking the question whether or not breath tests being less intrusive might be an alternative. And Justice Alito, who raised the prospect of future technology with a sort of a diabetes-like needle stick rather than a full blood draw. A second sort of issue that had some mixed relevance, I thought, was raised by Justice Kagan, and it's a, sort of this notion of cost-benefit analysis in terms of the seriousness of the incident. So the example being, if you had an accident in which alcohol was suspected, that would be a very serious incident, and your need for accurate and quick evidence would be pretty good, at least in terms of enforcing the law, you know, say negligent manslaughter or something like that. versus a routine stop where no one was hurt, there was just some weaving and you just want to preemptively enforce, versus sort of basic public drunkenness where you're not even behind the wheel of a car, and so that's presumably less serious than driving while drunk. And again, that sort of fit in with the Schmerber totality of circumstances test, but noting that the nature of the stop or the nature of the arrest would have some relevance to the need for a warrant. And if you recall, Schmerber did indeed involve an accident in which alcohol was suspected, whereas this case was a routine stop. So the cost-benefit analysis in this case is less compelling in terms of needing to go forward without a warrant than it was in Schmerber. A third theme with some mixed relevance I thought was just an interesting little side debate, hardly a debate, a side exchange between Kennedy and Scalia, where there was some question about what relevance is it that other states have a particular rule and the experience in other states. So many states do not excuse the warrant requirement. So many states require a warrant in all circumstances for a blood draw. They don't have any exigent circumstance exception in DUI cases. And that's just as a matter of state law. And Justice Kennedy asked, well, does it matter that many or most states have been operating under a warrant rule in these situations without seeming ill effect, that they have managed to do it reasonably efficiently? There's not any great evidence that it's particularly hurt prosecution or conviction rates, and that the evidence they get is sufficient. And from Justice Kennedy's questions, one suspected that he thought it was actually quite relevant to the reasonableness of whether or not you continue to require a warrant or whether you excuse the warrant requirement, whether it would be reasonable to excuse a warrant requirement. Well, if many other states are getting by and don't seem to have terrible effects, then perhaps it's not so reasonable to excuse it. Justice Scalia, on the other hand, questioned whether or not we would look to other states, noting that, you know, other states may have those rules for a variety of reasons, not because they think they're good rules, but perhaps because they think they're constitutionally compelled rules. And in any event, that you don't look to other states to evaluate the reasonableness of practice in this particular state. And why I thought this was interesting, of course, is that it has echoes from Scalia and Kennedy debates in the Eighth Amendment context, where one looks to the practices and policies of other states in deciding whether some particular punishment is cruel and unusual. Of course, there is quite a bit of overlap, I imagine, between the notions of unusual and unreasonable. And, you know, cruel and unusual and unreasonable, you can see that the analyses would be somewhat comparable, particularly where you're trying to set out a nationwide rule. So I thought this was an interesting debate. It didn't really go anywhere other than a few questions, but again, it was sort of a tantalizing little sort of a tease about some Eighth Amendment debates in the past and perhaps in the future. And then finally, one just interesting theme and point that the respondent raised that I think is worth noting is that in answering why this case was different than your typical destruction of evidence cases where you don't need a warrant. If you think the perpetrator is about to flush the drugs down the toilet, you can go in without a warrant to stop that kind of destruction of evidence, and there are lots of cases that say that. And in distinguishing those cases, the respondent's lawyer, Steve Shapiro, pointed out that in this case, in blood alcohol situations, the destruction of the evidence, while happening at a sort of a steady rate or a slow and steady rate, is not within the perpetrator's control. It's not something that he can manipulate or do something to, and it's certainly not an all-or-nothing event. So once the drugs are down the toilet, they're pretty much gone, and that's the end of it. Once the gun is tossed in the river, the odds of recovering it are pretty slim. And so you have an all-or-nothing scenario where either act now or lose the evidence, as opposed to here, where you still have evidence, it's just not as good evidence, or it's diminished evidence, or you now have to resort to extrapolating backwards over the period of delay to figure out what blood alcohol was when the person was driving, as opposed to what it is an hour to 2 hours later when you've actually taken the blood. And I thought that was an interesting and valid distinction that still lets you preserve these sort of exigent circumstances in the usual case without necessarily having to cross-apply them here, where the destruction of evidence is slow and steady and not an all-or-nothing event. So just to sum up, I think at the end of the day, the state loses, the respondent wins, the decision below is affirmed, and that we are unlikely to get any kind of bright-line rule. We'll stick with a totality of the circumstances rule, but which does acknowledge that where particular local circumstances or particular circumstances on the time and date of the event make it difficult to get a warrant, that warrant requirement will be excused, but that we're unlikely to excuse police officers from at least making an effort to get a warrant where that is at all feasible or at least at all possible. But of course, if they can't get the warrant in a timely fashion, my guess is the court will say it is okay to go forward and take a blood draw without a warrant. But in this case, what that means is that the defendant will win, the respondent will win, the state will lose. But in other cases, at the end of the day, it really won't be that much of a burden on the state. All they have to do is sort of make the effort, and by the time they get to the hospital and wait a few minutes, if the warrant hasn't come through, I think there's a pretty good chance that this court will say it's okay to go forward. I mean, that is, for example, that is the position of Justice Ginsburg, and if Justice Ginsburg is on board with that kind of approach, it's hard to see that the others wouldn't be on board with it as well. And so the states eventually will be able to do warrantless blood draws as long as they sort of make the attempt to get a warrant. So if they can't get the warrant in a timely fashion, they'll still be able to get their evidence. So while the state loses this case, I suspect at the end of the day, states and law enforcement jurisdictions in general will come out ahead from this result with a relatively better argument as to why they get to do it once they've reached the hospital and still haven't heard back from the magistrate. Well, that's all. Again, this is Eric Jaffe. Thank you very much for listening, and have a good day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.